Sadly, Chile was not the only country in South America to be singled out for the U.S. government's attentions. Guatemala, Costa Rica, Ecuador, Brazil, Peru, the Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Honduras, Panama, El Salvador, Peru, Mexico, and Colombia. They've all been the playground for covert and overt operations by the CIA. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been killed, tortured, or have simply disappeared under the despotic regimes that were propped up in their countries. If this were not humiliation enough, the people of South America have had to bear the cross of being branded as people who are incapable of democracy, as if coups and massacres are somehow encrypted in their genes. This list does not, of course, include countries in Africa or Asia that suffered U.S. military interventions: Vietnam, Korea, Indonesia, Laos, and Cambodia. For how many Septembers, for decades together, have millions of Asian people been bombed and burned and slaughtered? How many Septembers have gone by since August 1945, when hundreds of thousands of ordinary Japanese people were obliterated by the nuclear strikes in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? For how many Septembers have the thousands who had the misfortune of surviving those strikes endured the living hell that was visited on them, their unborn children, their children's children? On the earth, the sky, the water, the wind, and all the creatures that swim and walk and crawl and fly. Not far from here in Albuquerque, is the National Atomic Museum, where Fat Man and Little Boy, the affectionate nicknames for bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were available as souvenir earrings. Funky young people wore them, a massacre dangling in each ear. But I'm straying from my theme. It's September that we're talking about, not August. September 11th has a tragic resonance in the Middle East too. On the 11th of September, 1922, ignoring Arab outrage, the British government proclaimed a mandate in Palestine, a follow-up to the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which Imperial Britain issued with its army massed outside the gates of Gaza. The Balfour Declaration promised European Zionists a national home for Jewish people. At the time, the empire on which the sun never set was free to snatch and bequeath national homes like a school bully distributes marbles. How carelessly imperial power vivisected ancient civilizations. Palestine and Kashmir are Imperial Britain's festering, blood-drenched gifts to the modern world. Both are fault lines in the raging international conflicts of today. In 1937, Winston Churchill said of the Palestinians, I quote, "I do not agree that the dog in a manger has the final right to the manger, even though he may have lain there for a very long time. I do not admit that right. I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." That set the trend for the Israeli state's attitude towards Palestinians. In 1969, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir said, "Palestinians do not exist." Her successor, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, said, "What are Palestinians? When I came here to Palestine, there were 250,000 non-Jews, mainly Arabs and Bedouins. It was a desert, more than underdeveloped, nothing." Prime Minister Menachem Begin calls Palestinians two-legged beasts. Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir called them grasshoppers who could be crushed. This is the language of heads of state, not the words of ordinary people. In 1947, the UN formally partitioned Palestine and allotted 55% of Palestine's land to the Zionists. Within a year, they had captured 76%. On the 14th of May, 1948, the State of Israel was declared. Minutes after the declaration, the United States recognized Israel. The West Bank was annexed by Jordan. The Gaza Strip came under Egyptian military control. And formally, Palestine ceased to exist except in the minds and hearts of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people who became refugees. In 1967, Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Over the decades, there have been uprisings, wars, intifadas. Tens of thousands have lost their lives. Accords and treaties have been signed, ceasefires declared and violated. But the bloodshed doesn't end. Palestine still remains illegally occupied. Its people live in inhuman conditions, in virtual Bantustans, where they are subjected to collective punishments, 24-hour curfews, where they are humiliated and brutalized on a daily basis. They never know when their homes will be demolished, when their children will be shot, when their precious trees will be cut, when their roads will be closed, when they will be allowed to walk down to the market to buy food and medicine, and when they will not. They live with no semblance of dignity, with not much hope in sight. They have no control over their lands, their security, their movement, their communication, their water supply. So when accords are signed and words like autonomy and even statehood bandied about, it's always worth asking, what sort of autonomy, what sort of state, what sort of rights will its citizens have? Young Palestinians who cannot control their anger turn themselves into human bombs and haunt Israel's streets and public places, blowing themselves up, killing ordinary people, injecting terror into daily life, and eventually hardening both societies' suspicion and mutual hatred of each other. Each bombing invites merciless reprisal and even more hardship on Palestinian people. But then, suicide bombing is an act of individual despair, not a revolutionary tactic. Although Palestinian attacks strike terror into Israeli citizens, they provide the perfect cover for the Israeli government's daily incursions into Palestinian territory, the perfect excuse for old-fashioned 19th century colonialism dressed up as a new-fashioned 20th century war. Israel's staunchest political and military ally is, and always has been, the U.S. The U.S. government has blocked, along with Israel, almost every U.N. resolution that sought a peaceful, equitable solution to the conflict. It has supported almost every war that Israel has fought. When Israel attacks Palestine, it is American missiles that smash through Palestinian homes. And every year, Israel receives several billion dollars from the United States, taxpayers' money. What lessons should we draw from this tragic conflict? Is it really impossible for Jewish people who suffered so cruelly themselves, more cruelly perhaps than any other people in history, to understand the vulnerability and the yearning of those whom they have displaced? Does extreme suffering always kindle cruelty? What hope does this leave the human race with? What will happen to the Palestinian people in the event of a victory? When a nation without a state eventually proclaims a state, what kind of state will it be? What horrors will be perpetrated under its flag? Is it a separate state that we should be fighting for, or the rights to a life of liberty and dignity for everyone, regardless of their ethnicity or religion? Palestine was once a secular bulwark in the Middle East, but now the weak, undemocratic, by all accounts corrupt but avowedly non-sectarian PLO is losing ground to Hamas, which espouses an overtly sectarian ideology and fights in the name of Islam. To quote from their manifesto, "We will be its soldiers and the firewood of its fire, which will burn the enemies." The world is called upon to condemn suicide bombers, but can we ignore the long road they have journeyed on before they arrived at this destination? September 11, 1922 to September 11, 2002. 80 years is a long time to have been waging war. Is there some advice the world can give the people of Palestine? Should they just take Golda Meir's suggestion and make a real effort not to exist?